dates respectively of 3060 BC plus or minus 470 years, 2740 BC plus or minus 640 years, and 3100 BC plus or minus 540 years. These dates are broadly compatible with the Old Kingdom, although with some reservations which we'll explore below, but they do not, under any circumstance, rule out a much more ancient date of construction for the limestone core masonry of the temples, since it has always been Robert Schock's contention that the granite sheathing was added in the Old Kingdom to repair and restore the earlier, much earlier, Sphinx Age limestone temples. We are left, then, with only a single sample, sample number 5, which was taken from the original limestone core masonry of the Sphinx Temple. It yielded a surface luminescence date of 2220 plus or minus 220 years, but really nothing very conclusive can be said about it or deduced from it, since its location does not rule out the possibility, as Schock observed when I asked him to comment on these findings, that it may also have been exposed or reworked during repairs to the structure during the Old Kingdom. In summary, the new study does not provide any evidence to confirm beyond doubt that the original limestone megalithic elements of the Sphinx and Bali temples were built by the 4th dynasty pharaoh Khafre, as archaeologists maintain. On the contrary, the only thing the study seems to demonstrate for sure is that these temples were reworked during the New Kingdom. More alarming for the mainstream chronology, the surface luminescence dating raises the possibility that the granite sheathing on the temples, with the exception of sample number 6 with its New Kingdom date, was not added in the 4th dynasty at all, but many centuries earlier, indeed as early as 3380 BC at the extreme end of the dating range for sample number 7, as early as 3530 BC for sample number 3, and as early as 3640 BC for sample number 8. This potentially pushes what Robert Schock has always regarded as restoration work on the Sphinx Temple, the adding of a granite veneer on top of much older and extensively eroded megalithic limestone blocks, far back into the pre-dynastic period. In other words, long before any large-scale construction is supposed to have been undertaken in Egypt. And needless to say, if these temples were in need of such radical restoration in the pre-dynastic period, then their core masonry is likely to be very ancient indeed, perhaps even going back as far as the epoch of 10,500 BC. So much then for the Sphinx Temple and the Valley Temple, but what of the enigmatic pyramids that loom over them? The researchers were not able to study the second pyramid at Giza, conventionally attributed, like the Sphinx and its temples, to Khafre, nor did they investigate the Great Pyramid, attributed to Khufu. But they did test a single sample from the smallest of the three pyramids, which Egyptology attributes to Menkaure, the pharaoh who succeeded Khafre to the throne. Taken from the granite facing stones of the pyramid and not from its core masonry, this sample produced yet another strikingly anomalous date, 3450 BC plus or minus 950 years, when assayed for surface luminescence. Only at the youngest end of the range, 3450 minus 950 equals 2500 BC, does this date approximate to the reign of Menkaure, although many authorities do not see that pharaoh taking the throne until 2490 BC, and thus after his pyramid was completed, even at the most recent date offered by the surface luminescence spectrum. But what is more disturbing are the other possibilities raised by the dating, in other words, that the facing stones of the so-called Pyramid of Menkaure could have been put in place as early as 3450 BC, or even perhaps 950 years before that, in other words, in 4400 BC, and thus deep in the pre-dynastic period, almost 2000 years prior to the Old Kingdom. More work needs to be done to settle all this. As I've said, I remain willing, for the moment, to accept the still prevailing mainstream view that dates the pyramids to the Old Kingdom. But what is in the process of emerging, I think, is recognition of the need for a more nuanced view of the whole site, with strong indications from geology, from astronomy, and now from surface luminescence dating as well, that it can no longer be attributed exclusively to the epoch of 2500 BC, but rather appears to be the result of a series of developments over an immensely long time frame, going back more than 12,000 years. As Professor Ioannis Liritsis of the University of the Aegean, lead author of the surface luminescence study, concludes, parts of the site appear to have been reused, and it is a reasonable assumption that some of the structures were already present at Giza when the large-scale works of the Fourth Dynasty began. Nor is the question of the age of the site the only open one. Its function too is up for grabs. Egyptologists like to define the pyramids as tombs and tombs only. But as Professor Liritsis notes, the lack of contemporary human funerary remains from any Egyptian pyramid, and the obvious astronomical and geometric nature of the site that proved their orientation was not by chance, but in here knowledge and star configuration patterns at the period of construction, imply that the pyramids as tombs theory is no longer sufficient, and a broader determination of age, function, and reuse of both pyramids and Giza is required. This book, which descended from the sky. We've seen that there are many passages in the Edfu building texts which tell us that those amongst the gods of the early primeval age who survived the flood that destroyed their former homeland set about wandering the world with the purpose of establishing new sacred domains in suitable locations. One passage names a specific location that some of these gods found their way to, the first place they settled in Egypt. This turns out not to have been Edfu in upper, southern Egypt, but rather the city that the Greeks later came to know as Heracleopolis, which is located in lower, northern Egypt, and which the Egyptians themselves named Henen Nesut, meaning the house of the royal child. Archaeologists do not know where Henen Nesut was established, but a reference to it on the Palermo stone, so called because it is now kept in the archaeological museum of the city of Palermo in Italy, sheds some light on the matter. An ancient fragment of inscribed diorite, the Palermo stone, provides information, dismissed as mythological by Egyptologists, of some 120 pre-dynastic kings said to have ruled in Egypt prior to 3000 BC. But it also gives details of the early dynastic period, which Egyptologists accept as historical. An entry on the stone, dating to the reign of Den, the second king of the First Dynasty, suggests strongly that the origins of Heracleopolis Henen Nesut go very far back into the pre-dynastic period. But Henen Nesut is just where the trail begins, because it turns out it was closely associated with the ancient religious center of Memphis, Inbuhej, later Menifer, which stands about 60 miles, 100 kilometers further north, and was, according to legend, established by Menes, the first king of the First Dynasty, although again its origins are likely to be far earlier. It is therefore of interest, as Eve Raymond, the translator of the Edfu building texts, observes, that it is impossible to read the principal Edfu records and not be struck by the very pronounced Memphite background and tone that is still preserved in them. In her view, the Edfu texts preserve the memory of a pre-dynastic religious center which once existed near Memphis, a center which the Egyptians looked on as the homeland of the Egyptian temple. Note she is not saying which once existed in Henen Nesut, nor even in Memphis itself, but rather near Memphis. In short, the location is a bit of a mystery. Raymond supposes that archaeology has not yet identified it, but wherever it was believed to be a place carefully selected by the gods for the foundation of the first of the new generation of temples dedicated to the god Horus, the essential opening gambit in the long-term project to recreate the destroyed former world. A text on the inner face of the enclosure wall at Edfu was recognized as an important clue by Raymond in her own search for the mystery location, since it tells us that the primordial temple of Horus was built at the dictates of the ancestors, according to what was written in this book, which descended from the sky to the north of Memphis. An extensive burial ground for the ancient kings of Memphis, known to Egyptologists as the Memphite Necropolis, rose to particular prominence during the Fourth Dynasty, 2613 BC to 2492 BC, when, according to Orthodox chronology, both the Great Pyramid and the Great Sphinx are supposed to have been built. The pyramid fields of Dahshur, Saqqara, and Giza were all integral parts of the necropolis, so in theory, all might be candidates. But at Giza, as we've seen, the Sphinx models the constellation of Leo in 10,500 BC. The three pyramids model the belt of Orion in the same epoch, and the four shafts of the Great Pyramid lock on to specific stars in the later epoch of 2,500 BC. Far more obviously than Dahshur and Saqqara, therefore, it seems to me that Giza absolutely merits description as a book which descended from the sky, a book written with the pen of megalithic architecture in the script of precession. There is something else. The god Horus, for whom the primordial temple was built, is a complex figure who manifests in many different symbolic forms, notably the falcon. Indeed, an imposing granite statue of Horus the Falcon stands in the forecourt at the Temple of Edfu to this day. Horus was likewise frequently depicted as a man with the head of a falcon, a classic therianthrope, in other words, like the Apkallu sages of Mesopotamia. But Horus had another prominent avatar, and that was as a lion. Moreover, this Horus lion was sometimes depicted as a therianthrope, with a human head, and there is a specific inscription in the Edfu temple which tells us that Horus of Edfu transformed himself into a lion which had the face of a man. Mystery of the Sphinx. Given the connection that the Edfu texts draw with the Giza area and with that mysterious book descended from the sky, it is therefore impossible to ignore the fact that the ancient Egyptians closely identified Horus with the Great Sphinx of Giza. In this capacity, the lion-bodied and probably once lion-headed Sphinx was known both as Horemachet, Horus in the horizon, and also as Horakhti, which with a subtle difference of emphasis means Horus of the horizon. However, there's a very odd thing about the Sphinx. With the exception of Dr. Rainer Stadelmann, who believes that it was the work of the Fourth Dynasty pharaoh Khufu, all other modern Egyptologists are united in the opinion that the Sphinx was made by Khufu's son Khafre. I use the word opinion deliberately, because it's important to be clear at the outset that we are not dealing here with an established empirical fact about the Sphinx, but rather with a received body of Egyptological conjecture, which has gradually, through lack of opposition, begun to be treated as though it were a proven fact. As very often in our discipline, old and seemingly certain statements rest forever without further verification, comments Dr. Stadelmann, who should know what he's talking about since he was director of the German Archaeological Institute in Cairo from 1989 to 1998. When we confine ourselves to the facts about the Sphinx, rather than the opinions of Egyptologists, the first thing we discover is that no inscriptions have survived from the Old Kingdom which refer to this stupendous and imposing monument. Even the great Egyptologist Salim Hassan, who conducted extensive excavations at Giza in the 1930s, was therefore obliged to admit, as to the exact age of the Sphinx and to whom we should attribute its erection, no definite facts are known, and we have not one single contemporary inscription to enlighten us on this point. Neither, for that matter, are there any inscriptions from the First Intermediate Period, or from the Middle Kingdom, or from the Second Intermediate Period. Indeed, it is not until we come to the New Kingdom, roughly 1550 BC onwards, supposedly about 1,000 years after it was carved out of the bedrock of the Giza Plateau that the pharaohs of ancient Egypt suddenly start talking about the Sphinx. What Salim Hassan rightly describes as the earliest authentic opinion is given by Amenhotep II, 1427 to 1401 BC, who built a small temple that can still be seen today on the north side of the Sphinx enclosure. There, on a limestone stela, this New Kingdom pharaoh refers to the Sphinx under the names Horemarket and Horakhti, and also makes a direct reference to the Giza pyramids, which, to the annoyance of Egyptologists, he does not ascribe to his 4th dynasty predecessors Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure, but rather nominates as the pyramids of Horemarket. The clear implication is that in Amenhotep's time, far closer to the 4th dynasty than our own, there existed no historical archives, nor even any tradition, that linked the pyramids with the three pharaohs whom modern Egyptologists now insist were their builders. On the contrary, as Salim Hassan explains, the use of the epithet Pyramids of Horemarket suggests, since Horemarket was one of the names by which the Sphinx was known, that Amenhotep considered the Sphinx to be older than the pyramids. Chronologically, the next inscription referring to the Sphinx occurs on the famous Dream Stela of Thutmosis IV. The story goes that before he ascended to the throne, the future pharaoh was out hunting one day around Giza, where the Sphinx lay forgotten, buried up to its neck in sand. Thutmosis took a siesta in the shade of the giant head, at which point a vision of sleep seized him at the hour when the sun was in the zenith. And he found the majesty of this revered god, speaking with his own mouth, as a father speaks with his son, saying, "Behold thou me, see thou me, my son Thutmosis, I am Horemarket, who will give thee my kingdom on earth." However, there was a condition, for the Sphinx said, "The sand of this desert upon which I am has reached me. My manner is as if I were ailing in my limbs. Thou shalt be to me a protector." To cut a long story short, Thutmosis understood that if he were to clear the Sphinx of sand and restore it to its former glory, he would become pharaoh. Accordingly, he did as he was instructed, and when the restoration was complete, and the throne was his as prophesied, he erected the Dream Stela in commemoration. If you visit the site today, you can still see the huge stela. It's nearly 12 feet high and more than 7 feet wide, standing between the paws of the Sphinx, directly in front of the monument's chest. But much of the original inscription from the 13th line onwards has flaked away. In the 1830s, however, a cast was taken of it, at which time some, though unfortunately not all, of the 13th line was still intact. There the single syllable kaf, no longer present today, was noted, and from this, as the American Egyptologist James Henry Breasted comments in his authoritative translation of the stela, many have been inclined to conclude that the Sphinx was the work of Khafre. Such a conclusion, Breasted adds dryly, does not follow. He points out that there is in fact no trace of a cartouche, the oval sign that normally enclosed royal names, on the copies and casts of the stela that were made in the 19th century, which suggests strongly that the syllable kaf did not refer at all to the 4th dynasty pharaoh Khafre. Moreover, as Salim Hassan later added, even if the cartouche had been there, we are not at liberty to conclude from the damaged line that Khafre made the Sphinx. At the most, it would tell us that Thutmosis in some way connected the Sphinx with Khafre. Even Gaston Maspero, who was the director of the Department of Antiquities at the Cairo Museum in the late 19th century, and who did believe the cartouche had once been present, saw no reason to deduce from such flimsy evidence that the Sphinx was Khafre's work. On the contrary, his preferred interpretation was that the purpose of Thutmosis in this part of his inscription was to recognize a former renovation and clearance of the Sphinx undertaken by Khafre. Consequently, Maspero wrote, we have here almost certain proof that the Sphinx was already buried in sand in the time of Khufu, Khafre's father, and his predecessors. Maspero would later change his view.